Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Thursday, August 13th. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producer is Christian Ryan. Our video producer is Mike Tassoni. Thank you so much for their help. As always, Ben, let's just say this. It's Thursday. We are coming off of that two-game series against the Miami Marlins that the Blue Jays played. Amidst this cursed year, right, of 2020, in which everything is so grim and demoralizing at all times, it was somewhat of a sign of normalcy, somewhat of a feeling of comfort to see the Toronto Blue Jays participate in what had to be one of the most ridiculous baseball games I think that I have ever seen played. Like, I feel like over the last few seasons, like, I've found a few occasions on which to say that. So, you know, the fact that the Blue Jays are back in games such as that, it's a sign that nature is healing, Ben, and it's a sign that we're getting back to ourselves.
Yeah, it felt oddly normal to see the Blue Jays play such a bizarre game and, of course, lose it. I mean, that's the kind of game that they deserve to lose, but they also, they had to win it. I mean, when you have so many home runs, when you have that kind of a comeback, you need to complete that against a team like the Miami Marlins, right? This year, you don't have that many chances to beat up on teams that aren't good. You got to take advantage of them. And so, you know, really disappointing outcome for the Toronto Blue Jays, I think, on a lot of levels. And in some ways, it was a very different game because they actually scored some runs. But in some ways, you saw some concerning signs that we have seen before. And particularly, I think, on the defense. I mean, that was the most egregious example. But man, they're not a good defensive team right now. And that was the clearest example yet.
You had, in that game, like 1,000 runs scored. And as you alluded to, I don't know if any of them could be described as particularly earned. You know, you also had walks on walks on walks on both sides. You know, you had ridiculous little league errors, you know, not only the defense, but also dudes ran into outs on the base paths, which is something that we have seen. You had a speed skater playing second base. Like, the entire thing was ridiculous throughout. But you're right. The defense has not been there for the Blue Jays. It was not there last night. The base running has not been there for the Blue Jays. And, you know, you kind of, they say that, like, little errors like that and little miscues like that really show up in close games or in, like, low scoring games. They really show up in that game as well, because the Blue Jays don't make, like, some very basic fundamental errors and some mistakes that they really ought not to at the major league level, they win that game. And they have a series sweep over the Miami Marlins, who, by the way, like, you should beat if you want to go to the playoffs in the year 2020. The Miami Marlins, like, half their team is still on the COVID IL. John Birdie is their two-hole hitter. You know, Justin Schaefer is coming out of their bullpen. Like, Birdie and Schaefer, guys who could not make 89 loss Blue Jays teams, you know, could not crack a 95 loss Blue Jays team when they were in this organization. As I alluded to, they are literally starting Olympic speed skaters on the infield. You have to beat that team if you're the Toronto Blue Jays. Just make too many fundamental errors. You play too sloppy baseball. You end up giving away a game that you really ought to have won. And you can't do that too many times in a 60-game season.
No, you can't. And amazing story, by the way, to have a speed skater and not just an Olympian, but a medalist. I mean, that's incredible. But the Marlins are a team that's been put together off the cuff. I mean, you think about a guy like Logan Forsythe, who almost took AJ Cole deep down the left field line in the opening game of the series. And Forsythe was just on the scrap heap. I mean, this is a guy who didn't have a major league job until the Marlins had this COVID outbreak. And then all of a sudden, he's out there almost hitting bombs against the Blue Jays in leverage. So, you know, this is a team that you should beat. Some of this comes down to Nate Pearson, of course. I mean, we'll get to Pearson and his struggles in his third outing of the season, and third outing in the major leagues, of course. But to me, 15 games into the season, we're at, you know, one quarter of the way through, 25% through this season. And what I'm seeing now, Arden, is a team that doesn't look like a playoff team and doesn't sound like a playoff team. Like, if you're coming off a 5-8 road trip and you're saying that's a good road trip, to me, it doesn't sound like a team that believes it's destined for the playoffs. And maybe that's understandable. Maybe that's, you know, probably the most likely outcome for this 2020 season was that the Blue Jays would end up being in another sort of development year. But it is a little disappointing because there was that potential in a shortened season with expanded playoffs for anything to happen. And right now what we're seeing is kind of more of the same. I mean, it's a better team. It's obviously a better team than it was last year, and they're not going to be at a 95 loss pace, but 6-9, I mean, they deserve that record, really. And I think they've had some close calls, to be sure, and they could have won a lot more games than they have to this point. But it's also not an entirely undeserved record. They should be below 500 the way they're playing.
It's funny how that last little bit changes our perspective about the playoffs because, you know, like 25 minutes before the season started, Rob Manfred was like, oh, hey, 8 teams per league, make the playoffs now. We're changing everything. And all of a sudden it became, hey, the Blue Jays should win now. Like they should be in the playoffs now. But if this were a 162-game season with a regular playoff format, a traditional one, I don't think anybody would have picked the Toronto Blue Jays to make the playoffs. And I think everybody would have been much more okay with the developmental season that we are seeing playing out at the major league level right now with guys like Nate Pearson taking the mound and not having his fastball command and having to figure it out, with guys making outs on the base paths and guys learning new positions and some of the just, you know, developmental things, the minor league things. You know, that game on Wednesday night was very befitting of the ballpark that it was played in. It was a minor league game out there, played by a lot of guys who would probably be in the minor leagues right now during a regular season if COVID wasn't a thing. But all that aside, like, it's funny how it does change expectations. Just because the playoff format has changed, like, why would you expect the Blue Jays to play any differently, right? Like, you know, of course they're still going to play the same level of baseball and the same caliber of baseball that they would have no matter how many teams make the playoffs. So, like, I don't think that anybody should be, like, surprised by what they are seeing on the field. But I do think that expectations have shifted, and maybe that's just coloring some of the perspective of what we're seeing.
And it's a team that has a lot to learn. I mean, that's becoming really apparent, is that this is a talented team. But, you know, you watch, for example, Vladdy playing first base, and man, like, he is so far from a finished product there. And it's not just the error, of course, but it's little things like when Danny Jansen wants to pick off a runner at first base, and Vlad's just not there. He's not picking up on that. He's not ready to field that potential pickoff throw. So those things add up. It's impossible. Well, I shouldn't say impossible. It's very difficult to quantify those things. And, you know, as a result, we're looking at a team that does allow some unearned runs, that doesn't escape innings and can sometimes let these situations get away from them, even with Nate Pearson, right? I mean, Pearson and Vlad, they're cornerstone pieces for this team in the future. And yet neither one of them looked like a polished product in that Wednesday night game against the Marlins. And maybe we shouldn't expect them to look like polished products either. Vlad is learning a new position. Pearson is making his third major league start. Of course, Pearson's potential is on display when he's throwing 100 miles an hour. But if you're not throwing it over the plate for strikes, if you're not throwing your slider over the plate for strikes, it honestly doesn't matter. And he made the Marlins, like, again, this is not a good offensive team. This is not a good baseball team, objectively speaking, in the context of Major League Baseball. And he made the Marlins look like an offensive juggernaut. Like, Francisco Cervelli is just spitting on his breaking stuff. You've got Matt Joyce having good at-bats, Dickerson having good at-bats. The Marlins aren't a joke. I mean, they're okay, but they're not the Yankees. You know, they're not the Astros. And Pearson made the Marlins look pretty good. And by his own admission afterwards, he said, you know, I was not good. He was obviously very disappointed with the start.
These things can be simultaneously true. The Blue Jays could be playing awful, really bad baseball, but they can also be developing and they can be building for the future at the same time. And I just think that, you know, if this was a 162 game season, everybody would be saying, yeah, look, they're still young. They're still learning. They're still getting up to speed. It wouldn't be the, oh, you're blowing this like huge opportunity. But hey, these things can be simultaneously true. When it comes to Pearson, he just did not have his fastball command against Miami. He didn't have command of anything, really. Like, he just did not have anything working for him. So, you know, you can throw a bunch of pitches with great spin and great velocity, and you can sequence them, you know, however you want, but if you can't put them in the zone, professional hitters at this level are going to recognize that, and they're going to make you work out there, and they're going to make you throw another pitch and another pitch and another pitch, and they're going to force you into the zone, because if you don't come into the zone, you're going to walk in a run like Nate Pearson did. Right now, I think the key for him is kind of balancing, figuring this thing out, right? And, like, you know, mechanically, what's going on? Why has he struggled with this command to this point? What little tweaks can he make? What can he do in side session? What, like, small adjustments can he make? But also not doing too much and not, like, tinkering like crazy and not overdoing it to a point where you, like, mess yourself up even further. Like, there is really kind of, like, an interesting balance there. It's going to be cool for me, just as somebody who's interested in development and interested in, you know, the trajectory of young players, to watch that play out and to kind of see how he learns that on the fly. You know, that's something that typically would be happening away from our eyes in the minor leagues, right? Like in AAA or, you know, at this point in Nate Pearson's career, but we're watching it play out in the majors. So it's going to be kind of cool you know, for me to watch that. But I think that's the thing for Nate right now. He went through something similar in the Arizona Fall League a couple of years back. He had an outing just like this one against Miami where he was just awful. Like he couldn't find the zone, gave up a bunch of runs and, you know, didn't have his command, this, that, and the other. And he was able to figure it out then. So I'm sure he's going to look back on that experience and say, all right, what worked for me then? Like, what was I able to do in order to get myself right again? You know, the difference is now he's doing it in the major leagues and, you know, his next time out probably going to come against a pretty good team.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Pearson very clearly has some really high expectations for himself. And I think Dan Shulman and Buck Martinez on the broadcast have done a really good job of highlighting some of the moments where you can see Pearson's emotions are there and he's having trouble kind of managing them to some extent. And that's totally understandable, I think, given the stakes and given some of the plays that are made or not made behind him. But I'm thinking of the pop-up that dropped in shallow, I believe it was right field behind Kevin Biggio there. And then Pearson's kind of looking up at the sky, you know, saying, without saying it, he's saying, I wish I had that out. I thought I should have had that out there. I don't think it's showing up his teammates by any stretch, but it shows that Pearson's really getting swept up in that moment. And if you picture, you know, the best case scenario for Nate Pearson 5 years down the road, if he can become one of those aces that he certainly has the potential to, like a Gerrit Cole or a Justin Verlander, then those are moments where he's going to have to compose himself a little bit quicker and then start throwing strikes again and not dancing around the edges of the strike zone. So as you said, Arden, I mean, these are developmental lessons. You would not expect any pitcher, I mean, whoever it is, even on a smaller scale, because Cole and Verlander are Hall of Famers. So let's even say that, you know, it's Mike Clevenger or Shane Bieber or someone who's just an emerging ace, Lucas Giolito. Even those guys have learned those lessons, but they've had a lot of time to learn them too. So again, it's going to take some patience. It's going to take some reps, and Pearson's in the midst of that process right now.
Nate Pearson, one of the top pitching prospects in baseball, wasn't overly sharp in this one.
You mentioned, you know, Nate Pearson kind of looking up to the heavens, like, what the hell is going on? You kind of see the same thing with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at the plate right now and some of the results that he's getting, you know, some of the ground balls and some of the pitches that, like, he is miss swinging on, you know, because he is, like, getting, you know, inner half fastball on thigh high type of pitch that he would like dominate in the minor leagues, I'm sure, or like, you know, elevated breaking balls that are just hanging up there for him to punish. And he is getting ground ball results on them. And you see that frustration from him at the plate. And I've kind of, you know, I talked about this a couple podcasts ago, like just the mannerisms and the presence in the batting box right now for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is so much different than when he was in the minor leagues and, you know, had yet to reach a level that had challenged him. You know, he was so much more confident in the box and the minors and like doing like kind of Juan Soto-ish type of stuff, like, you know, watching pitches like all the way through and, you know, shaking his head when it's a pitch that he knows he should, you know, be laying off and it's just going to fall right outside the strike zone. And it does, right? Like, you know, he did like kind of cool little, like, you know, kind of shimmy type of stuff, like just type of like a physical manifestation of like how confident he was in the box. And we're not seeing that right now. We're seeing a guy who is like, looks really a lot like he wants to break his bat over his knee, you know, like a guy who looks really frustrated with some of the, you know, ball strike calls that he's been receiving. And look, that's going to be part of it for him, right? Like that adjustment, that mental approach, that's going to be a very, very big part of his development. And we can't say enough like how young he is, how players his age, you know, if they're coming out of college, have like just been drafted, right? Like Austin Martin is in Rochester right now. You know, like that's his trajectory has been a lot different than those players, but it is his second season in the major leagues. And you do have to hold him to the standard of a big league ball player. And right now he's not getting it done. But I think that type of, you know, mental development is a big thing for him as well, Ben.
Yeah, and the Blue Jays have said this for months and months now that, you know, it's not necessarily a swing issue with Vlad, or it's certainly not purely a swing issue. A lot of this comes down to pitch selection and the way that he works a count. And we have seen him chase in the majors more than he chased in the minors. And this is something the Blue Jays are well aware of. Ross Atkins this week was spelling this out pretty clearly that, you know, Vlad Guerrero Jr. right now is not taking quite the same pitches. He is expanding the zone more. He is hitting more balls in the ground. So all of that adds up to a much different strikeout to walk ratio than we would expect from Vladdy. And, you know, you mentioned his kind of mannerisms and what we see from him between the lines, just, you know, facial expressions, the way that he's acting out there on the field. And to me, it's always, I've always gotten the sense that Vladdy is someone who wants to have a lot of fun on the diamond. Like when he's at his best, he's someone who wants to be out there just being a gregarious personality, someone who's got, you know, maybe like you said, a little bit of Juan Soto, a little bit of Adrian Beltre, a little bit of David Ortiz, like someone who's really enjoying it, someone who's pretty expressive on the field in a way that, you know, I don't think that Kevin Biggio necessarily wants to do that, even if he's performing at his best, even if he's totally in the flow of his performance and just succeeding and thriving. That's not the vibe that I get from Biggio, but Vladdy, it seems to me, wants to be there. And if he does start hitting the way he can, I think that's what we're going to see from him. And right now he wants to be there, but he's not. And I know he homered last night too. So, I mean, let's not be too hard on the guy, but there's clearly more strides he needs to take.
The profile right now is a guy who still hits the ball really, really hard. He's just hitting it down into the ground. You know, like you look at the Statcast stuff and like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is second on the team in hard hit rate, like second on the team in average exit velocity. Like he's just hitting it down to the ground. He's in too many ground balls. He's not fast enough to run any of them out and he's not walking enough. So it's pretty clear like the adjustments he needs to make and the tweaks that he needs to make. And I understand it's going to be like frustrating for fans to watch Vladimir Guerrero Jr. like go through that. And like it must be said, like the Blue Jays have not been good enough to this point. And like, you know, we've seen in some of these close games, like a big Vladimir Guerrero Jr. swing at the right time with a couple of runners on, or a defensive miscue that wasn't made, right? Like a play being made in the field could have really turned the fortunes of this team. Like that's actually how like close they are. Like that's how thin the margin is. That like just a few little like different breaks like that and different things like that occurring could have the Blue Jays with a positive record, you know, like above 500 right now, and could have them being like, yeah, we could, you know, sneak into that seventh or eighth playoff spot in the American League. But they aren't there right now because those plays haven't been made and because Vladimir Guerrero Jr. hasn't looked good at the plate. And like nobody on the team really has looked good outside of Teoscar Hernandez and Bo Bichette at the plate. Like they had this massive offensive outbreak on Wednesday night, but they're still, you know, second last in baseball in runs scored to the St. Louis Cardinals, who have played five games. So you know they're still like, you know, way at the bottom of the league and, you know, on base percentage and like all, like every offensive statistic that you would like to be in the top half of the league, and they are not. They are near the bottom of the league. So they still just have not been good offensively. Will they be better going forward? We'll see. I think it's a lot easier to, you know, do it against kind of like the fountain of 4A pitchers that was like pouring out of the Miami Marlins bullpen on Wednesday. It's probably a lot easier to go deep against them than it will be when, you know, it's the New York Yankees bullpen, you know, or when it's the Tampa Bay Rays who are throwing all kinds of like funky arms at you with crazy release points and deliveries and high velocities. But the Blue Jays will need to be better offensively and defensively if they're going to do anything this season. So it's kind of like, it's, you know, what we're kind of, you know, getting around here is that like there's these two paths here for this season, right? There's a developmental one, which is like what the season was probably going to be coming into it. And, you know, what is still very important is you're trying to kind of turn this thing around and build towards being more competitive in the future. But there's also the very real opportunity that was here for this team to qualify for the postseason in a short season with an expanded playoff field, you know, with some like pretty good pitching to this point. Those two things can like both be true, and they both are right now, in that, you know, the Blue Jays are learning some developmental lessons, but they are also failing at the major league level.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think that for a lot of us, even if the expectation was they'll compete, but certainly no guarantees when it comes to the playoffs, my thought was that it would at least take a little while longer before it became clear, or, you know, it started to seem clear that this would be more of a developmental year. 15 games in just feels kind of early for us to be getting to that point where you say this is kind of what it's looking like, but you can't deny it. I mean, this, you know, and I know there are only three games under 500. You give, you know, you sweep the Rays, you're at 500, you're good to go. You play Baltimore next week, maybe you're even over, right? But that's kind of a best case scenario. And rarely has this team played to a best case scenario result this year. So I'm just not expecting that there is going to be some instant turnaround. I don't think it's a bad thing to have this be a developmental year, but to see this team have those defensive lapses, struggle so much offensively through a quarter of the season, I understand they've been on the road a lot. I understand that it's been a difficult, you know, challenging few weeks for this team, but there have been a lot of missed opportunities. There's a sense for me that a little bit of disappointment for these first 15 games. Not that it's been disaster. I mean, they've avoided COVID. That's great. You know, knock on wood. Honestly, I mean, that is a success. I mean, COVID.
Nobody's ended up in the ICU. Yeah, that's right. Pretty good.
That's honestly, like, that is successful. They've avoided COVID. They've navigated this whole uncertainty around the stadium and built a new, you know, venue for themselves, essentially, in Buffalo. We've seen some good performances, like Nate Pearson in his major league debut, and Hyunjin Ryu, and certainly moments from other guys. But overall, between the lines, a little disappointing, in my opinion.
It ain't going to get any easier, Ben. You look at the schedule right now, like, there are not many off days left in the season. We're recording this on an off day here on Thursday, August the 13th. And then between now and the end of the season on September 27th, there are two more off days. That's it. like 6.5 week span. It's crazy. Wow. Blue Jays are about to play 28 games in 27 days, hopping around from like city to city to city, like a ton of travel in there, double headers in there. Like, you know, it's going to be interesting just to see how the depth of this club is tested, like, over these, you know, coming weeks. Cause look, there's going to be injuries and there's going to be guys whose, you know, arms are hanging and who aren't able to go. And you're probably going to have to go to, you know, 6-man rotation at some point. And you're going to have that double header in there, which is going to be like, you know, just throw a whole hinge into the whole deal where you need, like, how many pitchers are you going to need to get through those 14 innings that day, you know, which is like right in the middle of this like insane stretch that the Blue Jays are on. It's not going to get easy, but it's not an easy season for anyone, you know. And while the Blue Jays have been like more hard done by, I'd say, than, you know, some of the circumstances this season, just with not having a home ballpark and all the uncertainty and, you know, players who have like been on the road for weeks on end. I mean, every team is going through it to a certain extent, and every team has had these challenges. So, yeah, it's the thing we've been talking about this entire podcast. Like, it's hard to kind of, you know, be like, this is a failure. This is, you know, terrible. This is awful. What's happening? You can't do that. But you also can't be like, well, you know, they're just like mailing in this season and just developing and trying to learn lessons. Like, it's somewhere in the middle. But I guess what I'm saying is I haven't even figured out yet how to like kind of walk that line in between the two tracks of this season.
And look, there's still 45 games remaining. So there's still a lot of time. I mean, at least on paper, we'll see what happens with some of those makeup games and, you know, with the rest of everything. But there's still a lot of time for the Jays to change the story of this season. And 15 games, you know, it's significant in this year and it's significant any year, but there's still a lot of time. And maybe Pearson makes those developmental strides. Maybe Vladdy takes more than 2 weeks to learn the position of first base. I mean, that's pretty fair. So I'm not ruling anything out. Obviously, 2020 is a very unpredictable year when it comes to baseball and everything else. So certainly there's still time for a lot of possibility here. But I don't know where these comments landed with you, Arden, but when Charlie Montoya is talking about an opening road trip of 5-8 as being a good road trip, that is the kind of thing where I'm like, what are the expectations internally? I mean, if you consider that to be a good road trip, to me it's more like a road trip where some good things happened than a good road trip.
Yeah, I agree with you. Let's have the Charlie Montoya discussion on the other side of the break here, because it's a big one that we need to have. So we'll step away. But when we return, Charlie Montoya and many other things to do with Toronto Blue Jays here on At the Letters. All right, Ben. Charlie Montoya. It's been a topic. It's Toronto Blue Jays manager. Those things are both facts. What have you thought of the performance thus far through 15 games?
Well, I think you can look at it through a couple different lenses. And one is how he presents publicly and what he conveys publicly about the team. So we'll start there. So as I alluded to before, to me, I think if you're calling a 5-8 road trip a good road trip, it's just missing it a little bit for a team that has a chance to compete, for a team that has a lot of good players. And we're not around the team this year. No one is in the clubhouse. No one is on the field alongside these guys. So it's hard to get a sense of how those comments play in the room. So honestly, I'm guessing here. But if you're a major league player on a team that, you know, you think has a chance to win, then I would think you're expecting a bit more from yourself than a 5-8 start. And so I would think that, you know, your own expectations are going to be different than that. So that's kind of the first lens. And then the second lens is tactical and how he sets up his lineups, what in-game decisions he makes. And I like that we're at a point that these decisions are starting to matter for Charlie Montoya and for the Blue Jays. I mean, it's a lot more interesting than if you're in a 95 loss season and nothing really. is that significant. But I found a number of things that I don't really get, to be honest. I mean, batting Teoscar Hernandez eighth would be one of them. That's when he was kind of the only guy hitting. That seemed like a bizarre choice. To me, it seems like you want to load up your best hitters in the lineup and just put them at the top of the order and see what happens. So that was a decision that didn't sit all that well with me. And even, I know it's a small scale, but pinch running with Vlad in the tie game on Wednesday and putting Anthony Alford in at a time you have Randall Grichuk up at the plate. And, you know, if you're going to steal with Alford, that's one thing. But if you're just going to have him stationary at first base, I'm not really sure I see the point there, especially with two outs, which that was the game situation at the time. So we're nitpicking here. But to me, I think tactically there's room for improvement. Overall, I'm looking at, to me, an underwhelming start, but you know, obviously under difficult circumstances for the Blue Jays and for Montoya. What do you think?
Yeah, no, all managers get nitpicked to death, right? Yeah. Because like, you know, when a team isn't performing and when players aren't coming up with big swings or pitchers aren't executing like big pitches, like it's kind of easy to like look at managerial decisions and be like, oh, that's the reason. Personally, like I think, I don't know that a manager can win or lose you a game. I think they can kind of like move the percentage points like 1 or 2% in like either direction in terms of like win probability. Like you can put your team in a better position to win a game. Ultimately, it's on the players. I agree with you on some of the tactical decisions that we've seen, like even dating back to last season, it's been some bunts that I just have been like, what are we doing here? Like, let's let these guys swing. Like, there's been, you know, the batting order is one definitely. But then I also wonder, like, okay, so how does Charlie Montoya just sit down and look at, you know, the 28 players that he has and then just like start writing them into a lineup card? Like, how many people have input on that? Trainers, do they have input on that? Does front office have input on that? Do, you know, analysts and data people like have input on that in terms of swings and, you know, what just what makes sense analytically? Like I think they do. And I think that Charlie Montoya tries his best to be as collaborative as possible and to listen to as many people as possible and to satisfy as many people as possible. So like I know that he has final say on the lineup card, but I think there's a lot of input there. And I think he's managing a lot of those things. So I think that's why sometimes you see some of the weird alignments that you have. I think Teoscar Hernandez definitely should be hitting in the top half of this order, at least. I don't know why he would ever be hitting eighth. I would be very interested to like hear the process that led to that. Because like, look, Charlie Montoya was managed for a long, long, long time. Like he knows how hot Teoscar Hernandez bat was. Like he knows how well this guy's performing. He knows he needs some thump atop of his lineup. Like I promise you that he wasn't thinking like, yeah, let's put my hottest hitter down in the order. There had to be something else at play there. Like I just have to give him that benefit of the doubt because he's too smart of a baseball guy. Like he's been in the game for too long. I mean, I don't know what it is, Ben, but it had like, doesn't it kind of like stretch credulity that like that would be purely a decision on like, yeah, let me just like put a really good bat down in eighth, like in the eight hole in my lineup? Like, isn't that insane?
Yeah, yeah.
People who play baseball video games, right? Like, isn't that insane?
There's not a easy explanation for that.
There has to be another reason.
What he told us, I'm just going to take at face value, which is he wants to spread out the batting order. And he wants to have, you know, some different pockets of the batting order that are, you know, capable of generating some offense. So I'm going to take him at face value there. And to me, that's not a compelling reason. Because late in the game, you're having your top of the order come around one last time. You want your best hitters up. So I'm taking his comments at face value. Yes, other people have influence, but he's ultimately accountable for it. And the reasoning that he presented wasn't ultimately compelling to me.
Well, and so that's the other lens that you were mentioning. And that's kind of like the forward-facing lens of a manager. And a manager does have to be a forward-facing guy, a spokesperson for the team, somebody who communicates decisions and somebody who explains what's happening and like, you know, just a spokesman, essentially. And I think like Charlie Montoya has always struggled with that side of the job. Like we talked about this last year. Like it's something that he didn't get a lot of experience with in the minor leagues. And then it's not like he got kind of like a soft entry point to the majors, like in like, I don't know, like Milwaukee or like St. Pete, where like, you know, you got like maybe two guys on the Zoom call after the game, right? He's looking at a Zoom screen of, you know, like 20 of us after games and we all have a lot of questions for him. So like, it's, you know, been a tough adjustment for him. And I don't know if he's ever going to be the best communicator to the media. You know, like, I don't know if he's ever going to really excel at the forward facing side of this job. And if you're winning, it really doesn't matter. right? Like, and if the team is doing well, like, nobody's going to care about your comments. But it's when you're losing that we really hone in on those managerial comments. And I don't know how much of an impact they have in the clubhouse. Like you said, neither of us has been in a clubhouse in a very long time. So, like, we have no idea. You would hope the players aren't looking at what Charlie Montoyo is saying to the media. Like, you would hope that they're paying more attention to what he is saying to them. But then that also raises the question of, okay, so if Charlie Montoyo, like, kind of communicates kind of oddly with us and, like, kind of gives us strange reasonings for things and gives us, like, these, you know, kind of lines of thought that are kind of difficult to follow, well, is it also that way when he speaks to players? I don't know, but I'm not sure it's unfair to extrapolate from the way that he communicates with us to the way that he communicates with players as well. And so then you have to wonder if they even are a little bit confused with some of the explanations that they're getting for the decision making.
Yeah, a couple of things there. One kind of more positive for, you know, on behalf of Charlie, and one negative to point out, and one that I don't want to go without mentioning here. So I'll start with the negative here. Jacob Wagaspak, not on the lineup card, brought into the game. This is last week as we record this right now. That's, again, it's on Charlie Montoyo. And he needs to make sure that the pitchers he wants, the players he wants, are eligible to come into the game. And if it doesn't happen, that's on him. And if the umpires aren't letting him use a pitcher that he wants to use, I think you got to get tossed there. I think, you know, you've got to go old school and get yourself thrown out of that game, because Jacob Wagaspak should have been able to pitch. The Blue Jays announced the roster move where he was going to be eligible. They wanted him to pitch and they couldn't use him. So that's, to me, that reflects poorly on Montoyo and the Blue Jays. Then on a more positive note, though, I do think that in a lot of ways, he's the boss of these guys, right? He's the manager. He's making these decisions. And he's giving them a lot of positive feedback. He is searching for positives, even when, you know, maybe you and me, Arden, aren't going to see them, or maybe the fans aren't going to, you know, savor those positives quite the same way. Montoyo is someone who really does make an effort, and I think genuinely finds positives with his team on a nightly basis, even in the face of adversity. And so I think he deserves credit for that, because the season has been a grind for these guys. They're in the face of a lot of challenges on and off the field with their families, with the logistics of a pandemic, with the challenge of trying to excel. And Montoyo does a good job of staying positive in the face of all that. So I'll give him credit for that. I don't think that that's something that all 30 managers would be able to do. I do think he's exceptionally positive and genuine in his positivity. At times, though, you know, we have seen some of those tactical things pop up where, whether it's you know, an in-game decision or just the lineup card, those have to be disappointing from the standpoint of the Toronto Blue Jays.
I think you would prefer that to the alternative where it's like the super negative guy who after every loss is like, yeah, we suck. We're screwed. We're terrible. You know, like, and I'm sure there is like kind of a middle ground there. Right. And I think that people tire a bit of the moral victories, right? Like you know, they're on MLB.com trying to like sort the standings by we were in it. But at the same time, Charlie Montoyo is not wrong. The Blue Jays have been in a lot of games this season. He's not wrong that they have been like one swing away or like one miscue not made from winning those games. Like, he's not wrong. I think that, you know, a better tact to take is kind of what he took after the Marlins game on Wednesday night, where he said like, yeah, look, like, great signs from our offense. It was good that the guys rallied and they didn't quit, but we also weren't good enough. We were bad defensively and we need to be better if we want to win games. Like, you need to present both sides, right? Like, after demoralizing losses and, you know, after like tough games, you can't just present the positive, optimistic side. Like, I do think you need to present both, but you don't want to be too far in either direction. It's probably a tougher thing than like people appreciate, having to be a manager after the heat of competition, like after like a 4-hour game in which your team lost dispiritingly, and then to go and like get in front of a bunch of like doofuses like you and I, and then have to explain it, and then have all of your like comments parsed, and, you know, the people going through with a fine tooth comb, and like, it's not, you know, and like I said, if you're winning, nobody does that stuff. You know, you do want to appreciate that it's a bit tough what he's saying. But you said something interesting about the situation in Atlanta with the lineup card snafu, right? And so that's a situation. It isn't Charlie Montoyo's fault. Like, it does fall on him, but on his lineup card, Jacob Wagaspak was on the card. And on Brian Snitker's lineup card, Jacob Wagaspak was on the card. And as far as we know, the Blue Jays communicated to MLB that Jacob Wagesback had been activated and that he was on the roster. Like, they had done the digital process and gone through it. As far as we know, everything was done correctly. Somehow, it did not end up on the umpire's lineup card. But in that situation, as Charlie Montoyo, like, I can think of a lot of managers that would have been apoplectic, like, that would have been losing it. And, like, this is like my most old school take. Like, this is my, you know, most antiquated. Like, I even question myself when I, like, feel these things, right? Because I'm like, what's practical about throwing a fit? You know, like, what's, like, pragmatic about, you know, just being demonstrative and, like, losing it and, like, stomping your feet and storming around and yelling at people? It's like, you're a middle-aged man. Like, what are you, like, what are we doing, right? Like, this is ridiculous. But it's not the first time, like, I've thought that this season during the lineup card thing, where I've thought, like, man, Charlie Montoyo needs to try to get run here. Like, Charlie Montoyo needs to go off here. Like, it's not the first time that I've thought, like, we could use a little bit of fire from Charlie Montoyo. I think back to the game against the Nationals when Rowdy Tellez got thrown out in the 9th or the 10th inning. And to me, it was a pretty quick trigger ejection. Rowdy Tellez was unhappy with the strike zone. It'd been a frustrating night for the Blue Jays. He gets chucked. Charlie comes out, basically grabs Rowdy, brings him back to the dugout, doesn't say much to the umpire, doesn't put up much of a fight for his guy. And then the coaches behind Charlie are putting up more of a fight, to the point that the umpire actually, like, issues a blanket ejection to the Blue Jays dugout. Like, as we understand it, as Charlie explained it to us after the game, was that the umpire basically said, one of you has to go. And the Blue Jays made the decision of who was ejected, and Dante Bichette just, like, went back to the dugout. You're in a situation right now where an umpire has, like, just thrown out not only a player from your lineup, but, like, just one coach. Like, that was what he issued
a generic
the ejection
coach.
For. One, yes. The number one coach. So in that moment, like, you have every right as a manager to go to that umpire and say, like, what the hell are you doing? You need to have a reason to eject somebody. You need to have a person, a specific reason, a specific stimulus that is making you issue this ejection. Like, this is an abuse of power to just say one of you has to go. You need to identify why you are issuing this ejection. Like, I think Charlie could have lost it in that moment. Charlie shouldn't be compared to his predecessor, but I promise you John Gibbons would have been, like, you know, steam coming out of his ears at that point. So that was the other time I thought of it. And then the other night in Buffalo against Miami, the, like, shoestring tackle at second base of Lourdes Gurriel Jr., umpire indicates interference, points at him, Lourdes advances to third, didn't do it with haste, ended up being called out. Lourdes thought that the interference, like, gave him the free base. Turns out, by the letter of the law, by the rule, the umpires were right. Lourdes should have just gone back to second, and it's fine. Like, I think the rule is flawed. Like, I think that, you know, like, he was prevented from advancing to third. Therefore, he should be awarded third base. But, like, as Dan and Buck, like, properly pointed out on the broadcast, like, the rule was followed, and I'm sure that's what the umpires were explaining to Charlie. But at the same time, like, in that moment, if I'm Charlie, I don't just take that and walk back to the dugout. And I don't do that because Lourdes was incensed, because Louis Rivera was livid, because the Blue Jays bench was going nuts. And Charlie just didn't show enough fire in that point, in that moment, for me. You know, like, I can identify, like, these situations here where I think that another manager would have been chucked, like, 2 to 3 times this season. I've seen situations like that where Charlie has just been, like, a little too accepting of a loss, a little too passive in those situations. And I just do think, like I said, it's one of my most, like, antiquated, like, opinions, but I really do think it, that at a certain point, your players want to see some fire from you, and they want to know that you're going to go and stand up for them and fight for them. They want to know that you're as upset about what's happening as they all are. And it's not the most practical thing. It's not the most pragmatic thing, but I think it does have an effect, or at the very least, like, it prevents the negative effect of your players questioning why you're not doing it. The downside is that you, like, catch a fine from the league, essentially. Right. That's about it, really. Like, Charlie has that in him. Like, you talk to people who worked with him in the minors, like, when he was coming up, and they say, yeah, this was, like, a fiery guy back in the day. Like, this is a dude who would get, like, he would yell at coaches in the dugout. Like, he would go after umpires. Like, it's been there. We haven't seen that from him in the major leagues. Like, and I do wonder if, like, I just think Charlie's sometimes is trying to satisfy too many different parties, you know, like he's just trying to satisfy too many different people who have input on his lineup decisions or with us, right? Like he's pretty passive with us, like, and he doesn't really push back on any of the, you know, questioning that we give him, or he doesn't really, you know, stand up to anyone in the media even. I mean, like, I just wonder if, like, at a certain point in some of these situations, like, Charlie just needs to have a little bit more piss and vinegar, you know, like, I don't know, like, and maybe that happens and then he ends up getting, like, criticized for that in the same way, right? Like, and then maybe at that point, like, people like us are saying, like, what are you doing? Like, you know, you need to focus on the task at hand. Your team's losing, like, keep it on the field. Why aren't you being more positive, this, that, and the other? Like, maybe he's in a no-win situation. I don't know. But what I know is, like, what he's doing, like, right now is inviting a lot of questioning. That's for sure.
It is. And I think with that being said, just because, you know, I get some of these thoughts in my mentions, I'm sure you do too on Twitter. Hey, you know, are the Jays going to move on? I think that is by no means remotely on the table. So let's just say that. It's more so, to me, it's interesting to observe a manager when games matter, what decisions do they make? And that's not something we got to observe a lot of last year. And so just observing it, dissecting it, it's interesting to me to do in a shortened season. And I think we're learning about Charlie Montoyo. And of course, this is game, you know, 177 for him in his managerial career as a major league manager. That's not a ton. So part of this is he's learning things and learning lessons and adjusting as well. And I think that he deserves the chance to be able to do that.
The thing about the major league level is it will weed you out if you are not up to it, right? As a hitter, as a pitcher, as a manager, as a coach, right? Like at a certain point, like if you are not able to adjust and rise to the occasion and figure out how to be effective at this level, they'll find somebody else who can be effective, right? It's not the try league, it's the be effective league. Isn't that what he said? So let's touch on some other like smaller things here. Salem Field.
Blue Jays have a home ballpark for the 2020 season. It is the ballpark of their AAA affiliate, the Buffalo Bisons. It is Salem Field.
First of all, your first impressions of Salem Field dressed up as a big league ballpark.
I think it passes the test for sure. And I mean, let's give the Blue Jays credit. They had a very, very short lead up time to get this done. So I think you look at how it plays on TV, I think it looks pretty good. You look at some of the behind the scenes before and afters, which the Blue Jays have shared with us, and you can see, I mean, a pretty significant improvement in a short period of time. I think for the Jays, it seems like a pretty comfortable spot, and it seems like a good enough place to play their home games. For the visitors, it certainly looks like a no-frills setup. I'll put it that way. Looks like a no-frills setup. You're not going there expecting the five-star resort experience. But most teams are going to be there for a handful of games. They'll figure it out. And it has to be understood that this is a pandemic and this is something the Blue Jays had to figure out on the fly. And most importantly, it's safe. I mean, that's the bottom line for guys to be able to distance from one another, to operate safely. That's really the primary goal, as well as, of course, having the access to facilities and amenities that major league players are used to. So overall, to me, it seems like they did a good job in very, you know, challenging circumstances.
Yeah, I think that space is like the biggest impediment here. You watch the broadcast and it's like, oh yeah, there's a highway, like literally like running along the outfield wall, you know? Like you look at, you know, and we've both been in that clubhouse in Buffalo, in the home clubhouse with protocols and everything, they could have fit 15 people. And in the visiting clubhouse, they could have fit 10 people. That's why you're seeing the Blue Jays clubhouse is literally the entire like service level of like the stadium. The visitors are out in like a tent in right field because it's just not enough space. You look at why the bullpen mounds are on the field. There wasn't any space to put them anywhere else. Like that was like the biggest challenge here is that like pandemic baseball just requires a lot of room for people to spread out. When, you know, at Rogers Center, it's a lot easier. 50,000 seat facility, huge footprint there on Bremner, Salem Field, and at like, you know, pretty much every minor league ballpark, like you're just not going to have the same amount of space to work with. So I think the Blue Jays found some really creative and interesting ways to like use space. And you look at, you know, the gym on the concourse and, you know, the where they've kind of set up like the hitting cages and how they've laid things out, you know, using that space and beyond the right field wall for the visitors. Like I think the visiting team will probably have I would imagine, more space than anywhere they go. Like, we've been in those visiting clubhouses at major league ballparks. Like, they're going to have more space here for sure. They just aren't going to have the same amenities or the same luxuries that they might enjoy. You know, they are still like in a tent, you know, like, and if there is lightning, by the way, like, the tents are good for like wind and rain, but if there's lightning, the players actually have to evacuate the tents and go up to the suites within like the stadium proper. Even last night, looking at, I forget the name of the pitcher who came out with the injury, but there's like this great shot of this really long walk that he has to take to get back to his clubhouse in right field, like walking through the stands. Like, it's unideal, right? And it's, so I think that, you know, there could be some benefit there for the Blue Jays, and that visitors likely aren't going to be very comfortable, you know, being out there beyond that right field wall. Like, imagine being like Garrett Cole and making $36 million a year and having to cram into this like little shower stall after a, before and after an outing. Like, he just got out of the coal mine and is being like hosed down. It's going to be an adjustment for the visitors for sure. I think for these, like, look, these Miami Marlins, like, that entire team is just minor leaguers. They're just like, yeah, great. Like, what? Like, yeah. There's catering in the clubhouse? Amazing. Awesome. Yeah. You know, like, we take planes to games? Like, great, you know? But I feel like when, you know, the Yankees roll into town, some of the perspectives might be a little different.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just the image of, you know, Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge and DJ LeMahieu and Garrett Cole, just, okay, there's lightning, guys. We got to pack up our stuff and walk in our pinstripe uniforms up to the concourse level. I mean, let's hope that doesn't happen. You know, it's a tricky situation. I'm sure, you know, for all these guys, wherever they are, whether it's New York or Boston, I mean, they're in makeshift setups for sure. So that part of it won't be new to them, but this is probably going to be on the more no-frills end of all those setups.
Yeah, and the one thing is, I think those bullpen mounds are going to come into play at some point. Like, I think it's tough with them out, like, whether somebody's going to eat it or like there's going to be a weird funny bounce or, you know, something's going to happen there. It just seems inevitable. You know, that's probably like the biggest, I think, downside of the situation right now, is just like having those bullpen mounds out there. Like, it's certainly not ideal, but like, there's nowhere else for them to put them. Like, they are using like every square meter of this ballpark. So, you know, all things considered, like, I think they did like a really good job with it. Clearly, like, a pretty massive investment went into it. You know, this was a lot of money and a lot of time, a lot of hours, a lot of resources. So I think the Blue Jays need to be commended for how creative that they were with it, but it is also going to be interesting to watch it play out, even just the way the ballpark plays. Like, it seems like to this point, like, if you're a right-handed hitter, like, get the ball in the air to left field, man. Like, it seems like there is a breeze that comes off of the lake from the right field foul pole to the left field one, and like, it is going to blow some balls out to right. You know, it's been interesting hearing pretty much all the hitters and pitchers mention that it's a pretty pitcher-friendly environment, but I think that that is kind of the one place where it is not, is just like, to, you know, left field as a right-handed hitter. Like, if Vladimir Guerrero Jr. figures out his swing and starts getting the ball in the air more often, I think he's going to hit some bombs in this ballpark.
It really is a pretty big unknown, right? Not having seen games there, so you don't have that kind of subjective, hey, what does this feel like to watch games here? And then even, you know, maybe some of these players have played enough games there, but for all of them, these are new surroundings. And in that way, you know, whatever home field advantage you'd get from, you know, just being comfortable in your home ballpark, the Jays probably have a lesser advantage on that side compared to a team that has played games upon games in their home stadium.
The last thing is the lighting, which, like, is not going to be up to the standards of a major league ballpark. Like, it just never is. It's not going to be what, you know, the Blue Jays players are accustomed to at Rogers Center or at any of the major league ballparks that they play in. We've already seen what Justin Schaefer was on the mound for the Marlins. Like, he could not see the signs, and he got crossed up with Cervelli like a number of times. It's going to be interesting to monitor that. And just to monitor, you know, like, you saw Cervelli in the second game of that series had like neon yellow fingernail paint on, just to be able to show those signs to the pitcher. It's going to be interesting just to see how the lighting plays in going forward. Last thing I want to talk to you about this week, Ben. It is August 13th. Toronto Blue Jays have played 15 games this season. Is it too early to talk about the trade deadline?
No, it is not too early. I think, you know, it feels bizarre. And when I was asking Ross Atkins about this week, I kind of prefaced my question by saying, like, this feels kind of weird to be asking you about this. But at the same time, we're a few weeks away. We're less than 3 weeks away. So it's interesting. I asked around this week a bunch of people kind of what their expectations are for the upcoming trade deadline. And the answer that I heard pretty consistently was that you should expect a relatively quiet deadline for a lot of reasons. I think, first of all, you have a lot of teams right now that are within striking distance of a playoff berth of some kind. So those teams are probably going to be less incentivized to sell and to part with players. That leaves you with a few teams who are out of the playoff mix, you know, and we can pretty safely say a team like the Tigers or the Pirates, I mean, they're not going to be contending this year. Put the Royals in that group as well. But even then, a guy like Chris Archer's injured. Our team's going to want to part with a lot of talent. Like, let's say Matthew Boyd, you know, he's not off to a great start with the Tigers right now, but let's say he recovers, has a great couple weeks. Are you, as a contending team, going to want to trade a lot of long-term assets for a guy who might only make four starts for you in September and potentially some playoff starts? That's a tougher sell than acquiring someone on July 15th, for example. So I think there's that aspect to it. And then there's even the logistical question of how do teams assess prospects or major leaguers for that matter? Because in a normal season, you have minor league games, scouts can attend those. Major league games, scouts in the weeks leading up to a trade deadline, you know, Arden, we see them in the press box all the time and you kind of try to identify who they're with. So that's the norm, but that's not happening this year. So there aren't minor league stats to go on. There aren't minor league scouting reports or major league scouting reports, unless it's off of a TV screen like the ones we're watching. So all of that creates this information gap between teams, and they're trying to bridge that. There's some video sharing and some analytics sharing, from what I've been told, going on between teams. So you can kind of get a little bit of insight into someone who's training, say, at the alternate site. But what about the pitcher who's in A ball and who's not even at the alternate site? What about the guy who's, you know, missed a week and a half because of some elbow soreness and the team's being a little cagey with that information? I mean, it is a really tough environment to make trades in. And for all those reasons that I mentioned, the people in the game that I'm talking to are not expecting a very busy deadline at the end of this month.
That's an interesting push-pull in the types of information that you share with other teams. Teams are, like, you know, so guarded with that stuff. And so I don't know if you're the Blue Jays, you're just sending somebody the Excel spreadsheet. Like, you would think some of these alternate sites probably don't even have, like, Hawkeye installed. They probably don't even have some of the player tracking stuff. So it would be very difficult. I think, you know, another thing is that my belief is that you can only trade players off your 60-man player pool.
That's right.
And I wonder if you get around that with, like, a player to be named later type of deal. Maybe we're just going to have this flurry of, like, PBTNL deals this year. But I, like, how happy would MLB be with that if their clubs are just openly circumventing their rules?
I mean, maybe the rules were put in place with the expectation that that loophole would come into use. But yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, we're going to see some small-scale moves. I mean, we're going to see relievers traded, maybe even some starters. I think the Blue Jays, if they fall out of it, it's pretty obvious what they're going to do. I mean, you look at what they've done each of the last 3 years. They've had veteran pitching. They've traded it. And it's pretty apparent if they were to fall. I mean, if they're three games under, I don't think they're going to be massive sellers. But if they really fall out of it, it's pretty obvious. You trade AJ Cole. If Ken Giles is healthy, he's in that discussion. Rafael Dolis, Anthony Bass would be in that discussion, maybe Matt Shoemaker. I mean, those are the guys that, based on previous years, the Blue Jays would be open to dealing. Then it becomes a question of what information can you get on other teams' prospects? Is it worth it? Because, you know, there's some value in just keeping those guys around and, you know, absorbing innings, having that depth. And if you believe, based on the information that other teams are giving you, that it's worth it and that some prospect is going to come and help this organization in the future, then you make that move.
Well, and what is a club willing to give up for 25 to 30 games of a guy in a That's season, right, which, like, nobody can really even be certain if it's going to be completed? There are, like, some interesting factors at play here that could, like, impact the return that you might expect on a Ken Giles or a Matt Shoemaker bet.
Totally. And I think, you know, you look at some of the types of trades that we might see, they might just be to fill out rosters. I mean, and hopefully, you know, the COVID outbreaks can be non-existent or, you know, at least very limited. But the reality that we've seen in the last couple of weeks is that teams are going to be dealing with COVID. And if that's the case, some teams might just say, like, we need arms, we need bodies. And then that could lead to some minor trades. But again, I don't think that you know, we're going to see those types of blockbuster deals that we would normally see this time of year.
So you mentioned you would think that the Tigers would be pretty clear sellers this year. That's a team that's 9-7. That's a team that by Fangraphs playoff odds has a 27.9% chance of making the playoffs.
Wow.
The Toronto Blue Jays are 6-9. All pretty much the inverse of that record. A 24.6% chance of making the playoffs. So a worse odds of making the playoffs per Fangraphs. Fangraphs projects the Blue Jays over the rest of the season to win 26.7 games. They project the Tigers to win 27.1. So by these objective measures, the Tigers have better hopes of success over the rest of the season than the Toronto Blue Jays based on their performance to date, based on their strength of schedule for the rest of the season. And yet you would say that the Tigers are clear sellers and the Blue Jays not so sure yet.
I would. I think it's all about, you know, where you are in your kind of cycle, and the Tigers pretty clearly are a couple of years behind the Jays at least. Maybe I'll be eating those words on At the Letters a few weeks from now. Who knows? But yeah, I think, you know what? What stands out to me about that comment is that the Jays actually still have a 25% playoff odds. So that's actually not bad. I would have guessed, honestly, it was worse than that right now.
Yeah, Fangraphs has them actually with better odds than the Red Sox. And the Red Sox have, the Red Sox played more games. They're 6-12 and the Blue Jays are 6-9.
So the Blue Jays at least have a starting rotation. So that's an advantage that the Boston Red Sox do not have.
Like the Red Sox are an interesting seller team.
I could see them selling.
That they have,
yeah,
right?
I could see them
Oh, for sure. But also like they would be dealing in some like pretty large financial figures that would have to be changing hands there unless they just paid the freight, right? And just to be able to turn some of these players into prospects. Like when I look at the Blue Jays, like, I don't know what they would really look to add. Like you would think like certainly a bat, right? Like that's, you know, what this team, like very clearly the offense has not performed up to expectations. But then like, okay, whose playing time is that coming at the expense of if you bring in a bat, right? Because you want Teoscar, Lourdes, Grichuk playing regularly in the outfield. Like you need Bo and Cavan and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And like, I don't know, maybe you get a third baseman and you move on from Travis Shaw, but Travis Shaw hasn't been given much of a fair opportunity to show what he can be this year. Right?
He's
missed so much time and he's been fine. Yeah. He's been around, but it's only, you know, I don't know. Does he have even like 25 plate appearances? Like, can you really like, you know, so who are like, I don't know where the playing time would come from if you brought in a bat other, like, I guess you could use the DH spot a bit more if you're going to bring in a guy and just kind of rotate him through. You're not going to have a lot of runway to do that. Would you go get a starting pitcher? I mean, this team's lousy with starting pitching right now. Like, you've got plenty of like interesting internal options. I think you'd rather go to rather than acquiring someone. The bullpen looks great right now. You know, if you like, Ken Giles isn't in it right now, and it, you know, hasn't been a huge problem. Like Anthony Bass has been really good. That, you know, obviously the blown save like aside, he's been good outside of that. Jordan Romano is like a revelation. You know, Ryan Barucki has looked great in a high leverage lefty relief role. So I'm not even too sure like where the Blue Jays would be adding to this roster if they weren't dealing away veterans at the trade deadline.
Yeah, if you're talking about the Jays as buyers, which is kind of interesting, I could see them adding a reliever. I mean, there's always room to add a reliever. So that's a pretty easy one, and the price you'd think would be relatively low. So you could see that, or maybe a DH, you know, platoon bat. You know, I don't think that they're necessarily going to go out and trade big future assets, right? That's not their style. And especially this year with all the logistics involved, I wouldn't expect that. But maybe, you know, this year's version of Steve Pierce, you know, some, a lefty masher, just someone to have as a DH, maybe room to carry a bat like that and just give Montoya an extra option or two late in games. But, you know, we're talking small scale stuff. At least that's my read is, you know, platoon bat or reliever. I don't think they're giving up the farm for, you know, whoever it is, whoever that top starting pitcher is available in a few weeks.
Don't have to give up anything but money to sign Yasiel Puig.
That's right. Still out there.
There's your fit.
Yeah. The Jays have not tuned into At the Letters from last week, or else Puig would be a Toronto Blue Jay right now.
I'll just keep banging that drum. He's Ben Nicholson Smith. He's on Twitter at BNicholson Smith. My name's Arden Zwelling. I want to thank Christian Ryan and Mike Tassoni for helping us out with the production of this episode. I want to thank you, as always, for listening. Talk to you next week on At the Letters.